Hello, listeners of the Accents podcast on WUKY. I'm your host, Katerina Stoikova, and my guest today is author, actor, director, screenwriter, singer, songwriter, narrator, and Zen Buddhist priest, Peter Coyote. Hi, Peter. Welcome to Accents.
How are you? Thank you so much.
I don't meet very often Renaissance personalities such as yourself. So the biggest challenge for me was to decide on the first question, where to start this conversation.
Okay.
And I finally decided to start where I typically start, with questions about your latest book.
Also, okay.
You are the author of Zen in the Vernacular, Things As It Is. How did you decide to write this book?
Well, I've been a student of Zen Buddhism since 1974. And I came out of the counterculture of the 60s with a lot of anger, a lot of political struggle, a lot of problems with drugs. And I needed a radical change in my life. I had a daughter whose mother had run away, and I had no money. And I needed to change what was going on the inside of me that was making me respond always with anger and outrage. So I had read a lot, and I had known a Zen Buddhist practitioner named Gary Snyder, a famous poet. And I admired him a great deal. And he was the f maybe the first person in my life I'd ever met that wasn't unevenly developed. Most people are unevenly developed. We have a talent and then we let everything else go. So you'll meet a great singer who turns out to be a wife beater, or you'll meet a great actor who turns out to be dishonest. Very few people work on themselves to be evenly distributed about everything. So the thing I noticed about Gary Snyder was that he did everything as carefully as he did anything. He treated repairing his car as carefully as taking care of his family. He treated his community that way. He treated building a house that way. And the more I studied him and thought about him, the more I thought that was really worth emulating. And much of his training came from 9 years in a Zen monastery in Japan. So I began courting a woman who was at a Zen monastery, and I began practicing with her in 1974. And these monasteries kind of study 13th century Japanese formalities and rituals. And there's a great deal about Zen that's kind of formal, but it's formal for a reason. For instance, if we teach you there's a way to sit, you sit upright, you tuck your chin a little so the back of your neck is long, you put your hands, one hand inside the other, and with your thumbs touching to make a little circle. And the reason they stress that is because it gives you a standard to judge how well you're doing. If your posture collapses, it means your attention collapses. If that little mudra, it's called, with the hands, your two thumbs fall apart or the circle gets flat, it means your concentration is down. So the rules are not there to exert authority on you. They're there to help you measure yourself against a standard that is objective. And so I spent about 8 years living across the street from this monastery. And I have to say, it changed me a great deal. I hated it when I first started. All these people walking around very correct and very proper, and not much in the way of laughter, not much in the way of ecstatic behavior that I was looking for. I liked it a lot, but after about 8 years, I began to think, as Buddhists, we take vows to save all beings. Means to save beings from ignorance, to save beings from the hypnotic delusion that we have a self inside us, which is like an organ, which is separate from the rest of the universe, which is not true. That thing we call the self is actually just awareness. It's formless, which is good news because it means anything about ourselves we don't like, we can train, we can practice, we can alter. But thinking of ourselves as separate divides the universe in two. There's self and other. There's me and everything else. And Buddha's fundamental observation was that nothing in the universe exists alone. I may think that I exist alone, but I've never existed apart from oxygen, from sunlight, from water, from microbes in the soil feeding the trees and plants that I eat, from people harvesting them, cooking them, selling them, growing the cotton, spinning the cotton, weaving my clothes. It's just an illusion to think I have a separate existence. It's not that I don't have self-awareness or self-consciousness, but Buddha called things empty because they were empty of self. And what that actually means is boundaryless. It means everything is connected. So I began to realize that there were a lot of people that would never practice Zen Buddhism and shave their heads and wear black robes and, give up their lives to replicate 13th century Japanese culture. And I thought I was more interested in creating a secular practice among people who had some spiritual instinct or some spiritual sense that could be helped by the discipline of Zen practice and its insights. And so I began to work with a teacher who had left the monastery. And I worked with him for a long time, and then he transmitted me, which made me an independent teacher myself. And I kept my practice in the secular world, working with people who might never run into Zen because they were never going to go to a monastery. So the book, Zen in the Vernacular, vernacular means the everyday language of people. So Zen in the Vernacular should mean the everyday behavior of Zen, how much of what we do we could think of as Zen.
Years ago, a Zen Buddhist friend of mine told me her definition of Zen, and she said that this is the elimination of unnecessary alternatives. Do you agree with that?
It's really interesting. It's actually quite profound. But the first question that comes to mind is who's doing the eliminating?
That's a very good question to throw back
Yeah.
at the question.
So I understand why she says that. And one of the things that meditation allows you to do is simply drop things that don't serve you anymore. It's not like you throw them away or your house cleaning. It's just as you get clearer and more at peace with yourself and more able to withstand whatever arises within you, you find that you don't need so much stuff and it just kind of falls away. So I like that notion of falling away better than I do of eliminating, which sounds very active and like there's an actor and he's taking separate things out of his psyche and throwing them in the junk pile.
I have a quote right here above my computer. Clutter is postponed decisions.
You bet. And you could be describing my desk.
How did you decide to become a priest?
I have to go all the way back to being maybe 14 years old, 13 years old. I was born in 1941. So in 1953, I was growing up and coming aware at the time of the McCarthy period hearings, where the government was making communists and socialists out to be devils. And I came from Jewish family with communists and socialists in it. And I knew the government was lying about my family. I mean, it was just dishonorable. I refused to salute the flag in school. So They were probably no longer communists, but they, when they were young, they had been communists. They had believed this ideology. They had tried it. They had been disappointed by Stalin, and they left. And they were teachers and union organizers and labor organizers and just nice people. And so I watched them, numbers of them, weeping in my living room as they were being called in to testify before a government who wanted to know the names of people that had been in the party with them or had been at a certain meeting with them. And if they refused to talk, they would lose their employment. So I grew up very early angry at my government. And there was much about the time I was growing up in, post-World War II, there was a lot of PTSD, which was not diagnosed, a lot of drinking, a lot of violence in homes. Certainly in mine. So I began reading and I stumbled on the Beats. And the Beats were the first grown-ups that I had ever discovered who could authenticate my feelings and my impulses. They had their own criticisms of materialism and greed and the way the United States was going all in to be an imperialistic power. And so they were all interested in Zen Buddhism. So as I got older, I began reading a lot about Zen Buddhism, but I didn't really learn about meditating, and I didn't really know any Zen Buddhists until I met Gary Snyder. So I was never going to be a priest, but at a certain point in my practice, my teacher said to me, "We've started a 3-year priest training program. I'd like you to take it." And I said, "Well, I won't be a priest." He said, "You don't have to be a priest. Just take it and see what you learn." I said, "Okay." So I did that. It was like going to divinity school. It was like a weekend a month for 3 years where we went down to a Zen center in the central part of California. And there were about 30, 35 people in the group. And by the time I was done, I was so impressed with those people. The quality of humanity, the quality of their thinking and their clarity, that I came back and I wanted to commit to raising my standards. So I told my teacher that I would ordain and become a priest. And that's how I did it.
And you're a poet. And as far as I know, poetry has been with you virtually all your life.
Yeah. So I think the first poem I wrote was when I was 6. And I actually think it frightened my father, who was a very practical man, very intelligent. He had gone to MIT when he was 15 years old, and he was very logical, and he was also very powerful. He'd been a professional level boxer and jiu-jitsu contender. And I think he thought that I was too sweet and soft that the world would eat me. And he thought it was his job to toughen me up. So that was not a good decision. But I always wrote no matter what. And I always kind of thought of myself as a writer. Even when I was in the movies, that was just a way to make a living so that I wouldn't have to write for money. But I was very private about it. When I graduated from college, I came to San Francisco to the School of Creative Writing to get a master's in creative writing. And I was studying with a genius level poet named Robert Duncan. And he was so intelligent, they had never been able to chart his IQ. And his lectures were like, they were like too big to encompass. He would go from some contemporary line in a poem to an Etruscan poem that reminded him of that, to Greco or Roman philosophers, to religious worships of the mother worshiping Cretan goddesses. And he was also cockeyed. He had one wandering eye. I could never tell who he was looking at. And I looked around, and the students in the room were all nodding. And I didn't have a fucking idea of what he was talking about. And I decided that I wasn't smart enough to be a poet. And so I left graduate school. But I never stopped writing. And a few years ago, I realized I had a drawer full of poems that I'd written over the last 50 or 60 years. And I called friends of mine who were poets. Gary Snyder himself is a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet. And they recommended people, and one thing led to another. And I began working with a wonderful poet and teacher named Patrick Donnelly. And we started meeting every 2 weeks, and we would go into this pile of poems and work on them one at a time. And some of them were not worth working on, but many were. And after 2 or 3 years, I developed a book. And the book, he said, well, I'm going to submit this book to Four Way Press, which is the best poetry publisher in New York, but it took me a year to get an answer from them, so don't get your hopes up. And 3 days later, they accepted my first book. And then they just accepted my second one, which they were going to publish in 2028. And I said, hey guys, I'm going to be 85 this year. You can't do this to me. If you're going to publish my book, publish it while I'm alive. So they've moved it up to this September. So I'm feeling better about it.
Wow, I wrote my poem, first poem when I was 8. That did scare my father because all poets he knew were raging alcoholics, and he didn't want me to have anything to do with any
Of
poems.
course,
And
yeah.
he also was a boxer. But that's not my question. It's just something to say back. I've always said that poetry is a matter of life and death. Do you agree?
Yes, it's, I mean, I feel that way for any artist. So when we're born and when we're being raised, everybody who talks to us is a teacher. We don't know it, but they're describing the world to us. And they're describing a conventional reality the way that they've been taught. And we don't have any defenses against it. We just accept it. But as we mature, we begin to find areas where it doesn't fit. Those of us who are artists, anyway. And what our art represents is a way of describing the world that we actually live in. We have to invent a way of talking between the square lines in the coloring book, that people color in. So every artist that I've ever known who was really an artist who gave it up went crazy. And that was also true of myself. I gave up writing for a long time. It just seemed the most important thing I could do was to behave like a revolutionary. And I gave up being an artist. And for all the time that I did that, it turned out that I was using heroin and just keeping myself asleep and not admitting all these other voices and ways of seeing things. So that's the way I understand it being a life and death matter. It's something I have to do to make sense of the world. I have to write. I just have to.
Thank you for that answer. I've always said that whenever I have spent time not writing, I don't really call it life. It is some kind of way of sleep living.
Yeah, I completely understand you.
So, your first book of poetry, the title is Tongue of a Crow. What is the title of the second one?
The second book is called Thumb to Thumb, dot, 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 and yet. So I need to show you this. I have to stand up. So this is the mudra when we sit zazen. We put, if you're left-handed, you put your left hand under your right hand, and you sit like this with your thumbs, and you make a nice rounded circle, no tension. You could pull a dollar bill through my hand. And if it collapses, your attention has collapsed. If the thumbs separate, so I call it your attention gauge. So thumb to thumb. And then there's a very, very famous poem by a Japanese poet named Isa. And after the death of his second daughter, he wrote this very beautiful haiku that in translation goes, "This dewdrop world is but a dewdrop world, and yet."
And yet, wow.
Yeah, and yet we still suffer, we still feel, we still go through the roller coaster of emotions. Even being enlightened, even being transcendent, you can't escape this. So it's called Thumb to Thumb, and Yet.
I love this title. It is spiritual and based in tradition. Would you mind reading us a poem or two from the new book?
Okay, this one is called Dukkha, Dukkha. And Dukkha is the first noble truth of the Buddha. It means affliction. And it means basically that we are all afflicted by things in life. The basic nature of life is to be afflicted. And you're not afflicted because you're stupid or because you're not enlightened. It's just what being alive involves. So here's a poem, Dukkha. Reading the poems of others, my suffering seems a meringue. This one severing the clothesline hanging his father from the cellar ceiling. That one forced to abandon the puppy, the doll, her shoes to save her life. Another buzzed out of the locked ward where her autistic daughter. We're all the Landes, the Muscovy, the Gradue and Manteau ducks, immobilized so the fat of everything can be forced down our gullets, the gavage, all of it, more than we can bear, no option to stop swallowing. That's a cheerful little poem.
That is so lovely.
Here's another one. This is called Black Dog Out of Nowhere. Black dog out of nowhere locked onto my ankle some days ago. Maybe leapt from the brush or surfaced from a deep lake. We got welded together, and you can imagine how hard life has become with a dog swinging from my ankle with each step. I can barely squeeze him through the wide legs of my house pants. Can't see his eyes, only hear and feel his subsonic growl, his teeth fretting my bones, which now moan like a Greek chorus of the damned. My friends are embarrassed to visit. The dog doesn't like most of them anyway. The ones he does like frighten me. As they calmly pluck the pistachios from the dates, I set out to be polite, nodding assent and making clucking noises as they finger my food.
Oh, I love the absurd quality and the deep symbolism here.
This is called Issa in Mind. Pre-dawn Zendo chill. One chipping chickadee defying the silence, spitting weak candle warming the Buddha, tang of incense, pat and tap of condensed fog dripping off the shingled eaves, 50-odd years, thumb to thumb sitting, and yet not a word on my first book of poems sent months ago to my friend, the master. This is called Wild Nature. Decades ago, I came to him, friend and mentor, concentration dispersed, suspecting my mediocrity. Well, there are two models, he said. The guy with one sheep will always, at first, appear remarkable. Polished hooves, fleece combed free of thorns and brambles. Elegant collar and brass bell. The guy with 20 must fend off bankruptcy every day. Just keeping them in sight would be a victory. But 20 years on, both will guide well-tended charges through the open gate. 50 years since that talk, the gate now large and close. I can stand among the shepherds in my crushed brown hat. But teacher, it's hard to admit how little today I care for the docile sheep, the stump-free pastures, hauling feed for anything. It was always the wild-eyed dogs I loved, panting in the trees, eyeballing all that pretty meat, whimpering, making it all up every day.
I am so excited for your book. I'm excited for everyone who will read it. And I so appreciate you reading a few of them for our listeners.
Well, thanks so much.
I have to ask you about narration and lending your voice to books. I have listened about a dozen times to your narration of The Four Agreements.
Ah, so.
Was it fun to read that?
Oh, so much fun. Yeah, I became friends with him. I did two books for him. I don't do books much anymore unless I really, really believe in them, because to do a normal book takes 3 or 4 days and they pay almost nothing. And, you know, I need my time. I'm 84. It's like I need my time. But his was, you know, he wrote a book on vernacular Zen.
Wow.
You know, it came from another tradition, let's say a Yaqui or a Zapotec tradition, but it was the real deal. And so I loved reading it.
I loved how simple it was.
Yeah.
And I loved his short, pointed sentences. And I loved that this book wasn't 400 pages.
Have you ever read the book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind?
I have not.
So it's a book that I narrated on audio tape by the Zen master Suzuki, Suzuki, that founded my Zen center. And he was the same kind of person, only Japanese. If I had a copy, I would send it to you, but you can get it on Amazon. It's not expensive. And you can get an audio book and hear me reading it.
Do you plan to do audiobooks from your poetry?
Well, I've done my own, but even my own, sometimes on the third or fourth day as I'm reading, I'm thinking to myself, doesn't this guy ever shut up?
Did you ever think of doing radio?
Yeah, you know, I did, and I tried to actually get a radio started on a local station, but they wanted me to pay for it, and I couldn't afford to pay for it. I used to have a public television show called, I had two actually. One was called Outside the Box, and the other was called, I forget what it was called. And it was nationwide, and it was on public access television channels. And the only reason I stopped was because the producer couldn't offer me enough time to check data for me. And so a couple times I said things on the air that weren't true, that they had gotten me. And so I said, well, if you want me to continue, you have to do this. And they were too small to be able to afford it. But on my show Outside the Box, it was very popular because I had a talking stick. And a talking stick was something used by North Coast Indians. And I'd have a panel of guests and someone would get the talking stick and no one could interrupt them. Everybody had pads and papers to take notes. And everybody loved it. The conservatives loved it. Nobody had to worry about somebody playing gotcha, you know, and taking advantage, making you sound stupid. So they turned out to be very, very deep conversations. I had the guy on that show who was the head of the Marines, who was investigating Iraq to see if they actually had weapons of mass destruction. And he told me, and he told America, a week or so before the invasion, our equipment is so sensitive, if there had been one molecule of radioactivity, we would have found it. They don't have these weapons. So I love doing this.
How amazing to use the tools and the wisdom of the indigenous population to apply to our contemporary life, for us to act civilized with one another.
Remember that the idea of a bicameral legislature in our Congress came from the Haudenosaunee Indians, the Iroquois, the seven nations of the Iroquois. We call them Iroquois. The name is Haudenosaunee. These people were the same humans as we, and they lived here for at least 7,000 years. And they worked out systems of self-government and the relationships between independent liberty and the necessities of tribal living that we would have done well to acknowledge. And also, had we acknowledged the way they've figured out how to live here, we would not have destroyed our country and placed ourselves on the verge of global warming.
I have to ask you, how does one manage so much creative energy? You've done so much with your life throughout all these decades.
You know, I can't take any credit. I really can't. But I have this curiosity. And whatever I was curious about, I just followed. I didn't invent something to follow. I would read something or hear something or learn something and go, oh, that's interesting. Wonder what that's about. And then I would just dive into it. And I just did that over and over and over and over again. It's not that I was so smart or so creative. I just gave myself away to the subject.
Having accomplished so much, do you still have ideas and goals you haven't been able to tackle?
I don't know. I won't know until I get curious about something. There are things I regret. There are goals I pursued that I didn't pursue 100%, that I can, like movie acting. I could wonder, well, what would have happened if I'd done that 100%? But right now, no, I don't have very much pending. I have a new wife. We've been together 4 years, but we've been married two. And it's such a good relationship. It's the one I was looking for in all the others. So really, a thought came to me the other day. The only antidote to toxic masculinity is serving the visions of women.
I don't know if I understand that.
Well, what it means is that men who use their strength and use their power for self-advancement are oppressing the world around them. And they're missing the other half of the species, which is designed to make their energy healthy and nourishing. It's what women do. And so for men to understand that and to serve women to help them make their visions palpable in the world, because most men ignore women. You know, it's a boys' club. And I had a mother, I had a sister, I had two wives, brilliant, all of them. Spent their lives being ignored by men or run over by men or ruled by men or something. And I've done a lot of thinking about this. And I really realized that it's so the reason I tell you this is because what I try to do now is serve my wife and my daughter, you know, and just see how, what are they doing that I can help? Because that'll take care of the world. I taught a class once at Harvard about how to run political protests in a way that would not have them turn into Republican campaign videos. You know, they wouldn't be co-opted. And the very first thing I said was, let women organize them. Put women in charge of organizing them. It will be more collaborative, more communicative. It will be a bigger net. Start there. And then there were four or five steps that went under there, but that was the first one.
I like what you said about the masculine serving the feminine, because it would be reciprocal.
Yeah, it's
And
automatically reciprocal.
yeah, it's automatically reciprocal, and reciprocity makes everybody stronger and makes the world a balanced place, don't you think?
Absolutely. So if you think about nature, right? Nature includes the nature of nature includes everything. Positive, negative, masculine, feminine, nothing exists by itself. So the idea that the world exists to serve the visions of just men is a neurotic assertion. It doesn't hold water. It's only factoring one half of one little quadrant of the universe. So if you exclude the feminine from your own understanding of yourself, you become toxic masculinity. You become an ICE agent.
My biggest fear about my own life is that I won't be able to achieve my potential, that I could have done more with my time. What do you say to that?
The very first thing I say is, how do you know? In other words, why do you instinctively trust the critical voice in you and not the voice that says, Katerina, you've done so many things in your life. You've been the poet, you've been the this, you've been the that. I don't know if you have children or if you have a lover or if you have a partner, but I know from talking to you for 30 minutes that you've not wasted your life. And so to have an idea of what you should be doing, that idea may be wrong. That idea may not be including your whole life, may not be including all the time you spent being kind to friends, comforting the helpless, in conversations that were helping you grow and learn and nourish yourself. If you're an artist, and I think you are an artist, your nature is the nature of nature. There's nothing bigger than that. So where you are is where you should be. And why listen? That voice is probably your father's voice or your uncle's voice or someone's voice that had these ideas for you, but their ideas were never as big as your reality. So just think about it. You don't have to agree, but.
Thank you, Peter Coyote, for spending time with me today and answering my questions and reading us poem after poem and telling us about your new book and about Buddhism and giving us some deep insight into the human condition. It has been joy and privilege alike. Thank you.